Hi, this is Tom from the Happiness Quotient. Thank you for dropping by. You are one of my favorite listeners because if you're listening to this episode, you're hearing it before we changed our name to the Happiness Quotient. Just so you won't be surprised when you listen, you'll hear me talk about Baker Street with Tom Pollard. Believe me, you are in the right place. We've changed our name, but the excellence of the podcast just keeps getting better. Before we get to the episode, if you haven't done so already, please subscribe wherever you're listening, and I hope you'll visit my Patreon page for exclusive content at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, and take a look at my YouTube page of the same name, where there are many Everest and music-related episodes, adventure-related podcast elements that can't be found here on the podcast itself. Thanks for being here. If you like what you hear, be sure to leave me a review, a rating, and share it with someone you care about. Now, on with the show. Welcome to Baker Street. This is Tom Pollard, Season 2, Episode 2. Have a fantastic episode for you today. Stay tuned. You're going to love it.
Nothing to kill or die for. Imagine all the people,
The music you're listening to is Reverend Freakchild off his upcoming album that has yet to be dropped as of today, but will drop on April 10th, 2020. His album is called The Bodhisattva Blues. I interviewed Reverend Freakchild last week for episode 1 of season 2. Reverend Freakchild. I'll provide a link to that website where you can go and find out about his album and where you can buy it.
Imagine all the people sharing all the world. You may say I'm a dreamer, but I don't think I'm the only one. I hope someday you'll join us, and the world will be as one.
One thing that happens in times of crises like the one that we are all going through right now, many of us at home, unwillingly or without having asked for this extra time, is this crisis presents opportunity. We have this chance. I guess I'm one of those people who see opportunity in crises, in bad things that happen, a way for us to look at the world from a different perspective and connect the dots, so to speak. It forces us to think out of the box. Being off balance causes people to start to invent new ways to walk. For me personally, I believe in the power of storytelling. There are people out there starving for good stories. Inside of each Baker Street with Tom Pollard, there is a story that provides hope and inspiration for people. To understand that in order to achieve our dreams and our goals, sometimes we have to take a chance and weather a storm in order to make our dreams come true. Today I have a fantastic interview with someone who understands what it takes to perfect a craft, somebody who has taken a vision and made it become a reality. His name is Tom Teal, and I met him at his guitar building workshop, which is just one thing that it is. I guess you could probably call it a woodworking workshop. He's an entrepreneur who has spent his life in pursuit of a craft, of refining a craft, not all the same craft. In his 20s alone, he made about 500 instruments, including guitars and 100 instruments of his own invention and devising, and the rest were dulcimers, which were advanced in their own right. And during the 70s, he had a conceptions studio, that's what it was called, designed and built custom furniture from log or lumber into high art craft for a nationwide clientele. At Teal Audio, he sourced exquisite wood from around the world to create award-winning loudspeakers for an international audience. At one time, they had 50 people making speakers, which were sold through hundreds of retailers in 30 countries around the world. His company is Northwind Tonewood. And I met him there working on a film of mine called Dream Heart with a young luthier by the name of Noah Rivers. Noah is a young luthier who has worked under the guidance of Tom to learn how to perfect the craft in his own right. They are so in love with wood, it was intoxicating to see them pick up different boards of wood, some 200 years old, and talking about what the idea is to discover if wood can speak in an instrument and live its second life.
Doesn't get any better than that.
Wow.
That's the outside slab of the tree. First cut, it's usually the best right under the bark.
This is a 5A piece of curly maple, but from the looks of it, she's pushing a 4. 5A is reserved for our, as people sometimes call, master grade of the best of the best. And when you have that category, a lot of people are like, oh, this looks like 5A, we gotta put it as 5A. But that category is directly reserved for the stuff that you don't see anymore, and stuff that, you know, it's a once in a lifetime thing, and, you know, it could be better.
Following Tom and Noah through a makeshift garage filled with different slabs of wood and boards of every different shape, size, and color was quite an experience. Noah began to show off a little bit of his knowledge as a young luthier, and Tom, the man who had imparted much of this knowledge upon him, was right there to concur. That's what primarily drew me in, was the relationship between an experienced and seasoned craftsman and a protege eager to learn and master the craft in his own regard, under whatever direction he's willing to accept or take, and whatever directions he or she is willing to go off on to different directions with.
So would it be safe to say that the way some people feel when they walk through a guitar shop, you guys feel that way when you walk through a wood, this raw wood?
That's right. Yep. And, you know, this wood has ended up in thousands of guitars that are world class. Somebody's building a $100,000 guitar, and some of our customers do, and it starts right here. And we follow it all the way through, and we get a little piece of that action. Every time we hear about that guitar, we know that we supplied the wood.
Tom has been referred to before as the wood whisperer. Believe it or not, the wood whisperer. He knows how to knock on a tree and tell if the music that it would make in a guitar would be beautiful music. Let's talk to Tom.
I'm Tom Teal.
And we're at Middle Crossing in the middle of New Hampshire. It's not on the map, but that's because we really don't want you coming to visit because we have work to do. What we do is follow our dreams. The dream is actually built around the guitar, America's love affair with the guitar. I found that dream when I was in my early 20s, built about 500 instruments, time of my life. There's a romance involved, but beyond romance, it involves every kind of thought. It involves history. It involves engineering, science, math, whatever you want to incorporate into the craft. I call it a high craft. One could spend their life pursuing that craft, and some folks are fortunate enough to do it. In our world of specialization and having a job and having a career, it's nearly impossible. So what we're going to be exploring is how some little corners of how one lives out that dream, which is building the guitar with the sound in my head, building something that can inspire either myself or someone I'm building it for. I think inspiration, music, the muse, those sorts of investigations are where we are, not in do you chisel it, do you sand it, do you glue it, how does you do it. You can go to any vocational school and learn what you need to build a piece of high craft. But building a guitar, another musical instrument, is a different world. It's so much more inclusive.
So as you said, back in the day, you built 500 instruments, and so you have this knowledge, this you've seen, you've made every mistake you could possibly make, and then you've nailed it just as many times and beyond. So at the, here you are, this guy.
Well, I'd rather stay closer to the truth.
Which is?
The truth is, rarely does one get to make every mistake and nail every truth and make constant progress. In my particular case, I had jumped school. I was in a PhD program, and I said, no way. And I set up my studio, and I built studio furniture and musical instruments. And musical instruments were my love. And I worked over a period of less than 10 years through my 20s to where I was. I traveled the eastern half of the United States and so forth. One has to develop, if one's going to make a wage, I had a wife and a child, and one has to make a living. In my case, I did. And so one works out a process where one experiments some. You know, you change this a little bit while you're making instruments or whatever your batch size is. And so, yes, I've learned a lot. I've learned a lot of things not to do. I've learned some things that worked. Beyond that, my studio morphed into a hi-fi loudspeaker manufacturing company. And in my 20 years there, went from startup with the dirt floor garage to 50 people and selling all over the world. Well, that's a different animal, but it's having to do with sophisticated sound, with reproduction of how harmonics are structured and all of that stuff. So I had had some music theory, I had built instruments, and then I spent a real good long stint paying close attention to the audio aspect. So what I'm bringing to the party is a pretty global understanding. That chore at Teal Audio was an engineering-oriented chore. It was how do you do it? How do you do it in production? How do you make sure it's right? How do you test it? All of that stuff. So there are lots of ways of approaching guitar making, and one is to try to understand everything, put some science on it, do experiments, do control studies, A-B tests, see what you... And you know what you could spend, and most people do, a lifetime doing that, and no more than you did, but not enough. So the what works is what works for me and what works for whatever student I'm working with, and that is to try to get a hold of a learning style, and how does this person learn? How do we learn what we learn? What do we know? What do we care if we can put in a formula or not, and go about it seeking advancement, that every instrument is better than the one before. I spent some time in Granada, Spain, which was the center of the old Andalusian guitar making where the instrument really was born. and enough time to talk to a lot of builders. And what it would often come down to, I would have questions of a novice. I was in my 30s. How does this work? How do you learn that? Why do you do this? Why do you do that? And the answer was in some form in Spanish of build 50 guitars. Once you've built 50 guitars, you'll have settled that. You'll have come to peace with it. You'll know in your bones, because there isn't a right answer and a better way and a wrong answer and a worse way. It's what is keeping you on this path of exploration. How are you going to find your way? It's more like finding your way in the fog. And so the instructional method is, how do I facilitate someone, myself and someone else, finding our way in the fog? Because we don't even really know what color the fog is. So Noah's building 50 guitars. He's 14 into it. And they're not 14 guitars that I would have built, and that's a good thing. And there's a lot of learning going on. Noah in particular has a very good instinct for design, form, materials, the art of it. So he's spending three or four times what I would have, in the instruction to build 50 guitars, is knock out 50 guitars. Let's, you know, whip them out, put them together, see what works, learn from this, do it again. And within a year, you could have 50 guitars, and you'd say, yeah, that's the direction I'm going. And we're not on that trip here, because every instrument is a presentable instrument, which, you know, in his particular frame of mind, I think that's where it is. And they're beautiful. When you see them, you're going to love them. How could you not?
That is awesome. Talk to me a little bit about that relationship of a mentor. And, you know, now you have this opportunity to just kind of share things and watch. And you just hit it. I mean, if we had to close the lights off right yeah. now, I could probably do it. But there's this very, and it doesn't have to be making guitars. It could be anything. This sharing of knowledge and this passion, this deep, like, it's in your bones. And he kind of, by osmosis, kind of gains from that, but also probably gives back a lot too.
Yeah, I hear what you're asking. And the first thing that comes to mind is I have wished that it could be different. I've gotten not nearly enough time, headspace, ability. I kind of imagined that I would be building, and Noah imagined that I would be building, and he would be building in the same room. And there are things to be learned. And the facts of my life haven't stacked up that way for personal reasons. So I would say the bottom line is that the mentor-mentee relationship is probably individual for every pair of people involved. There are some formal guidelines of apprentice and master, and we're not doing that, where the master knows everything he builds. The apprentice starts by sweeping floors and eventually gets an hour a day of instruction, and they get a certificate at the end, usually 3 years, and I know how it works. I've been part of some of those. We're not doing that. There are a lot of things we're not doing. He's not working under my tutelage. He's not really a student. So in our case, what has fallen out because of my distractions and because of his method of work is more of a proctor-protege. A proctor sort of shields and protects the protege from big mistakes, or tries to. And in that, give some guidance to what I've seen work and not work. You know, kick around ideas, be the other end of a conversation when he's, you know, when he makes the move and so forth. And, you know, if in my career I had to evaluate every aspect of every relationship when you're forming a group that's going to build something, make something, develop, I wouldn't know how to evaluate this particular relationship, because it's pretty loose. And but we have supplied a roof and a place, and I would say an attitude that what you're doing is valid. It's more than okay. When Noah came here as a middle of high school student, he had tried some things on the kitchen table and, you know, the basement and whatever, and they were definitely the work of an interested youth. It wasn't anything that he really would, I think, I mean, it was something to be proud of. It had been done, but it wouldn't hold up in the direct light of scrutiny. And over the period of his first guitar was really ambitious, had a carved back and unusual doming and of my devising, and it was highly unusual. It was unique, and when I look back on my work, a lot of my earliest work, I wouldn't want to show it to anybody now. You know, I was pretty much just finding my way in the dark, and his work while he's been here will be something to be proud of. It's not perfect, it's not evolved, it's not well developed, but you know what? It works, it sings, it's got soul, it's funky, you know, this is cool. So I feel good about having, you know, been part of that journey. And it is a journey. And when we get into later, there's more of the journey unfolding. This, you know, things are changing, and but anyhow, we've got, he's got some instruments to show for it. You know, I'm, when you become a grand old man, I'm a grand old man now. I turned 70 this past weekend. So then you can reflect on your life and all that because, you know, you're old. That, you know, having most of what we set out for, we don't really accomplish. We, you know, we try this and, you know, whatever. But having a first protege at this time of my life is good for me. You know, I see myself as a natural teacher with lots of limitations, but I like to share what I've learned. And so to have somebody on the other end of that conversation is really an honor and a joy.
Tell me about these catalogs. What are we looking at right here?
We're looking at a strange concoction of where fiction meets fact. And I've been in my whole life, one way or another, I've been in the exotic wood business. When I made my instruments, I sought out the wood, either on the stump or at an old mill or something. When I was in the speaker business, I traveled the world to identify ethical sources and so forth. So it's, wood is in my blood. I like it as a material. I like it as a story. I like it as a piece of natural history. And here in New Hampshire, which now is 22 years, I came here as part of a project that I've been involved in, where part of that was to supply a large quantity of specialty wood, turned into 17,000 body and neck setups for Eddie Van Halen's signature guitar when Peavy was making it. And when one is involved in wood, one has too much wood that one doesn't know what to do with, and how do you present it? Most people grade it by type and price and whatever, and there's a pile of wood. And I knew that didn't work. Didn't work for me. It didn't say what I wanted to say. What I wanted to say is there's a tree, or there's a beam out of an old building, or there's something that was sunk in a lake or something. And we're giving it, and this can sound corny, but we're giving it its next life. And this is a very real felt thing. If I were selling a commodity, I don't like selling, I don't like commodities. If wood were the commodity, it just wouldn't happen. I wouldn't go there. But there are these things, these trees growing, and they come to us by all kinds of different ways. You know, contacts around the world, whatever, and we end up making that, transforming it from wood of some sort into tone wood. Tone wood is a special animal. We can identify through experience if it's going to sound good in the tree, either growing or on the ground. Hit it with a hammer, kick it, do whatever, there are ways to do it, and we can visualize if there's knots or shakes or whatever inside. But if it has merit and one buys it, and one is usually wrong. And that's the hideous part of the business, is that you end up with the stuff that you don't want. As my career developed, I got wrong less and less. And so pretty much the stuff we have here and that we're going to look at here are winners. And anyhow, what we've got here is a particular log. It got a name, Dragon Tongue. The best of them get a name. It was given that name Noah and I were exhibiting at a guitar festival in Woodstock, New York, and we had what we call first samples in the green. We had some stuff that, and people looked at it, and somebody said, "Dueling Dragons, that look." And so anyhow, that's about as good as it gets. This is Red Maple Curl. Of the Red Maple isn't even listed in the you know, vocabulary of the wood guys. They call it Eastern Maple or Soft Maple. We have Sugar Maple, Black Maple, and those are the hard maples. We have Red Maple, Silver Maple, or the Soft Maples. And Red Maple has particular characteristics of strength to weight and resonance qualities that we like. It also matches the European maples of Stradivarius fame and so forth better than our other maples. So all of these things are in the background when one goes shopping for a log. And if I'm in the business of finding logs, I have scouts trying to show me, keep for, notify me of when the best logs are. And generally, we can't afford the logs we want. The wood business is international. The USA is one of the only countries in the world that allows export of raw logs. It's generally considered a resource to add value in your economy. We don't have to get into details, but the fact is that generally there are buyers from around the world who are willing to pay. They can pay whatever they need to for a veneer log. I've seen logs go for, in fact, I was a broker in a log that went for over $60,000. And in the world of lumber or guitar wood or whatever, there's just no way we can touch that. Well, one year, the Chinese, who are the voracious log buyers, this is perhaps 10 years ago, I've lost track, but anyhow, they went home early because it got warm in the spring earlier, and maple spoils, it has sugars in it, and it ferments. So they went home early, and the best wood is buried underground. They have they could have a lake, a pond. In this case, it was a sand pit, and they bury the logs under the ground and then put reflective surface over the top to keep it cool so that by the autumn when people come back, it hasn't spoiled. Well, this log was going to be buried, but we knew, my supply partner knew the log yard owner, and he gave us a shot at it, and we bought it at a price the most we'd ever paid for a maple log, but we took this log and brought it back, brought it to his place. We custom saw it. It doesn't look like lumber. So we create a catalog for every instance. It can be a story, it can be a log, it can be an event, it can be a storm, it can be whatever the organizing factor is that brought this piece of wood to us. In this case, it was this one log because it wasn't part of a conservation project or a tornado or a typhoon. It was just what it was. And it got named Dragon Tongue. When we bought it, it wasn't named Dragon Tongue yet, so it had a code for the year, the supplier, and so forth. I should say that it became two logs, became three logs, because the tree had two logs, a lower and an upper, and because we were doing this with this log, this being turning it into something tonewood, there was another log that had grown near it in the forest that had ended up in a pallet mill because it was crooked and defective. And we were able to buy that. So it was a forest brother to this log. So Dragon Smoke and Dragon Tongue are both collected under this catalog. So that's the book. And of course, every story needs an epic poem. So we have an epic poem of the dragon. And then we give a lineage of where it fits, where Red Maple fits in the pantheon of tonewoods, and something about this. And it's all fact-based, although we take some poetic license. But every fact in here of where it came from, how it was cut, the date, the supplier, all of that stuff is a documentation of the life of this wood and the instruments that will have been made of it. And when we get to, if something of note happens. This has a piece of prose that I wrote. This is a situation that developed in the development of this log. So it gets a story. And then when we get to the end, this is the first guitar that was made out of this log. In our imaginary life, we track lots of guitars. People send us baby pictures and so forth, but we haven't taken the time to incorporate them into the book. So that's called a catalog, and that's the Dragon Tongue catalog. And every instrument that we sell, we can track by sales information, serial number, the invoice, where it came from, and what's its whole story. There you have it.
Dragon Tongue, the name of an old piece of wood used in the collaboration of master and student. In this case, in the creation of a beautiful guitar. Tom Teal and Noah Rivers, two representing the ends of a spectrum, the melding together of knowledge and wisdom with eagerness and youth, undeveloped talents. The dragon itself is a complex symbol combining images of a serpent or snake and a bird, two images steeped in the idea of isolation. Together, they form one of the most powerful monsters, a monster that can create complete chaos or total beauty. While the dragon's a symbol of evil to some, in some traditions, it's also known to symbolize supernatural power, wisdom, strength, hidden knowledge. The coming together of these two has resulted in not one, but several catalogs. And now I'm referring to Tom and Noah, not the opposite ends of the spectrum of a serpent and a bird. We all have a catalog. We all are a catalog, with empty pages yet to be filled for creations that have not even been dreamed of. Like Dragon Tongue, it's a story not fully told yet. An otherwise nondescript piece of wood made intoxicatingly beautiful through craftsmanship and patience and insight and vision. A whole line of catalogs, which includes Dragon Tongue, can be found on Tom's website, northwindtonewood.com, although I say that with the caveat that this website represents only a slice of the pie of who this man is, but you should definitely visit there and take a look at these amazing catalogs. And Noah Rivers himself, you can go find his website at njrguitars.com. The music we're listening to is Reverend Freakchild off his new album, The Bodhisattva Blues. I've provided a link in the liner notes for where you can learn more about the album, how you can get a copy of this most excellent of blues albums. Thanks for visiting Baker Street with Tom Pollard. Remember, we create our reality with the thoughts that we empower. Keep yours guarded and pure, positive, and open to the undulations and hidden valleys that so color our lives. Inside each valley and undulation is yet another opportunity to see the world from another angle, an opportunity to learn how to walk in a different manner, to see the world for all the beauty that it has. This is Baker Street with Tom Pollard. I'll see you all real soon.
Ran down to the levee, but the devil caught me there. Took my $20 bill and it vanished in the air. Said, all right, I'm gonna take my time, a friend of the devil is a friend of mine. I get home before daylight, just might get some sleep tonight.
If you're still here, thank you for visiting. I hope you'll take a moment to subscribe wherever you're listening, and I hope you'll also visit my Patreon page for exclusive content at patreon.com/thehappinessquotient, and take a look at my YouTube page of the same name, where there are many Everest and music-related episodes, as well as adventure content and interview snippets that can't be found here on the podcast. Thank you for being here. I hope you'll share this, leave me a review, a rating, and come back soon.